All right, so ready to dive into another fascinating case.
Definitely, always up for a good legal deep dive. Where are we headed today?
Today, we're looking at Maldonado v. Ford Motor Company, a 2006 decision out of the Michigan Supreme Court.
Okay, Maldonado. And what makes this case stand out? Why pick this one for our deep dive?
Well, it really gets to the heart of some core legal issues, especially the tension between free speech and judicial authority. You know, that whole question of what you can and can't say outside the courtroom, particularly when you've got a case pending.
Yeah, that's always a tricky area. Pretrial publicity and all that.
Yeah.
I can see why this would be relevant for our listeners, especially those who are law students navigating the ethics of it all.
Exactly. And Maldonado really brings those ethical considerations into sharp focus. It provides a ton of insight into how courts handle situations where someone's right to speak their mind might clash with the court's duty to ensure a fair trial for everyone involved.
So, lay it on me. What's the backstory here? What kind of case are we dealing with?
So the case starts with Justine Maldonado, who filed a sexual harassment claim against Ford Motor Company and her supervisor, Daniel Bennett. Pretty standard stuff so far, right?
All right, sexual harassment case, we've seen those before.
Yeah.
So where does this tension that you mentioned start to come into play?
Well, early on in the case, there was a pivotal ruling from the trial court. They decided to exclude evidence of Bennett's prior indecent exposure conviction from 1995.
Okay, I'm seeing where this might be going. So they exclude this prior conviction, presumably because it could be prejudicial and influence the jury's perception of Bennett, but that doesn't mean the information just disappears, does it?
You got it. Despite that ruling, Maldonado and her attorneys, they went ahead and engaged in what the Michigan Supreme Court later called a concerted and wide-ranging campaign to publicize this excluded evidence.
Wow, okay. So they're actively pushing this information out there, even though the court explicitly said it wasn't admissible in the trial. That's bold. What kind of campaign are we talking about?
I mean, this wasn't just a casual slip of the tongue. They gave interviews to the media, made public statements, basically. They were really putting this information about the prior conviction front and center in the weeks leading up to the trial.
That's a pretty direct challenge to the court's authority, wouldn't you say? I mean, the judge said this evidence was out of bounds, and they went and made it a key part of their public narrative.
Exactly. And the trial court wasn't too happy about that. In fact, they were so unhappy that they decided to dismiss Maldonado's entire lawsuit as a sanction for this conduct.
Whoa, dismissal.
Yeah.
That's a pretty extreme consequence. So the trial court was basically saying, you disobeyed a direct order, and now you face the ultimate penalty. Your case is gone.
That's essentially it. Now, naturally, Maldonado appealed this decision. The Michigan Court of Appeals actually reversed the trial court's dismissal. They felt it was too harsh a penalty.
Okay, so went up the chain, but then what happened? Did it end there?
Not quite. Ford appealed to the Michigan Supreme Court, and they ended up reinstating the trial court's original dismissal.
So the highest court in Michigan sided with the trial judge. They agreed that dismissing the case was the right call, given how Maldonado and her lawyers had acted.
Right. And there's a key quote from the Supreme Court's opinion that really highlights the gravity of the situation. They point out that plaintiff admitted disclosing the expunged conviction to over 100 people.
Over 100 people. So this wasn't just about media coverage. It suggests a much broader effort to spread this information, almost like a grassroots campaign.
It does, doesn't it? And the court seemed to interpret this as a deliberate and blatant disregard for its authority. It went beyond just advocacy. It was like they were intentionally trying to undermine the court's ability to control the proceedings and ensure a fair trial.
Right. It's a fascinating case because it raises so many interesting questions about legal ethics and the limits of free speech. Like, how much leeway do attorneys have to speak publicly about a case, especially when sensitive information is involved?
Yeah, and it also gets into this idea of inherent judicial authority.
Inherent judicial authority. Break that down for me a bit.
It's essentially the idea that courts have certain powers that aren't necessarily spelled out in specific laws or rules, but they're fundamental to the functioning of the judicial system, like the power to maintain order in the courtroom, to enforce their own orders, and to ensure the integrity of the judicial process.
Okay, so that makes sense. It's kind of like an implied power that comes with the territory of being a judge. You have to be able to run your courtroom effectively.
Yeah.
But how does that apply in this case with all the free speech issues floating around?
Well, the Michigan Supreme Court learned heavily on that concept of inherent judicial authority when they reinstated the dismissal. They basically argued that even if there wasn't a specific rule that explicitly prohibited Maldonado and her attorneys from publicizing this excluded evidence, you know, a formal gag order or something, the court's inherent power to control the proceedings was clearly being challenged and undermined by their actions.
It's interesting because you also have things like the Michigan Rules of Professional Conduct, specifically Rule 3.6, which deals with trial publicity. So it's not like there aren't any guidelines at all for attorneys when it comes to speaking publicly about a case.
Right. You've got these professional rules that lay out certain boundaries for attorneys. But in this case, the Supreme Court seemed to be saying that even if there was some wiggle room in those rules, maybe they didn't perfectly cover the situation with Maldonado herself, since she wasn't a lawyer. The court's inherent authority to protect the integrity of the trial trumped any potential loopholes.
I see. So it was less about the letter of the law and more about the spirit of it. The court felt like its fundamental ability to conduct a fair trial was at stake, regardless of the specific rules in play.
Absolutely. And then, of course, you can't talk about this case without addressing the huge First Amendment implications. I mean, Maldonado and her lawyers argued that their public statements were protected by their right to free speech. So how did the court handle that?
Well, they tackled that head on. The Michigan Supreme Court cited a landmark case from the U.S. Supreme Court, Gentile v. Nevada. That case established a specific test for determining when restrictions on attorney speech related to pending cases are permissible. And that test is the substantial likelihood of material prejudice standard.
Break down that test for us. What does substantial likelihood of material prejudice mean in practice?
Essentially, it means that if an attorney's speech about a case is likely to significantly prejudice potential jurors and prevent a fair trial, then the court can step in and restrict that speech. The court in Maldonado adopted this standard, arguing that even though freedom of speech is a fundamental right, it's not absolute. There are times when it needs to be balanced against other important interests, like the right to a fair trial.
And this is a lower bar than the clear and present danger standard that's used in other First Amendment cases, right?
Exactly. The clear and present danger test is much more stringent. It requires a showing that the speech in question poses an immediate and serious threat to public safety or order. The substantial likelihood of material prejudice standard, on the other hand, is more focused on protecting the integrity of the judicial process itself.
So it's a lower threshold because the potential harm is different. It's not about preventing immediate chaos in the streets. It's about ensuring that a trial can proceed fairly and impartially, even if that means putting some limits on what people can say publicly about the case.
Precisely. And this really gets to the heart of the dilemma facing attorneys.
Yeah.
You know, where's that line? How do you advocate passionately for your client without crossing over into territory that could jeopardize the fairness of the trial? It's a tightrope walk for sure.
Definitely.
So getting back to the Michigan Supreme Court's majority opinion, what were their key reasons for ultimately upholding the dismissal of Maldonado's case? Their main focus was on the need for trial courts to have control over their own proceedings. They really emphasized the fact that Maldonado and her lawyers had repeatedly and willfully violated the court's order to not publicize the excluded evidence. And they did this even after being explicitly warned by the judge.
It wasn't just a one-time slip-up. It was a pattern of deliberate defiance. And the Supreme Court felt that this went to the core of the court's authority.
Right. They argued that if they didn't uphold the dismissal, it would essentially send the message that parties could disregard court orders with impunity, which would undermine the entire judicial process.
And they also addressed the argument that the trial court needed to show actual bias in the jury pool before taking such drastic action.
Yeah, the Court of Appeals had said that the trial court had to demonstrate actual taint before they could justify dismissing the case. But the Supreme Court rejected that, saying that the substantial likelihood standard from Gentile was enough.
So basically they're saying that you don't have to wait until the jury's already been potentially poisoned by pretrial publicity. The risk of prejudice is enough to justify taking action to protect the integrity of the trial.
Exactly. It's about being proactive, not reactive.
Yeah.
They also argued that the restriction on publicizing the excluded evidence was narrow and targeted. It wasn't a blanket gag order preventing anyone from talking about the case at all. It was specifically about this one piece of information that had already been ruled inadmissible.
They framed the dismissal as a last resort, a necessary evil in light of what they saw as blatant misconduct.
Right. They emphasized that they weren't happy about having to throw out the entire lawsuit, but they felt it was the only appropriate response to this level of disregard for the court's authority. They really drove home the point that you don't need ironclad proof of actual jury bias to justify sanctions. The mere potential for prejudice, that substantial likelihood, that's what they focused on. And they made it clear that they weren't going to tolerate actions that put that fairness at risk.
Now, as with many Supreme Court decisions, there were dissenting opinions in this case. What were the main points of disagreement?
Well, you had Justice Kavanaugh, who dissented primarily on First Amendment grounds. He was very concerned about the potential chilling effect of the majority's decision on free speech, especially when it came to criticizing the courts.
So he's basically saying, look, people have a right to speak their minds, even if what they're saying is critical of the legal system. And this ruling could make people afraid to speak out for fear of having their case dismissed.
Exactly. And he argued that the majority opinion went too far in restricting those First Amendment rights. He made the point that criticism of the courts is protected speech, and he felt that this decision could have a chilling effect on that. Then you had Justice Weaver, who had a different issue with the decision.
What was Justice Weaver's main point of contention?
Her dissent focused more on the procedural aspect of the case. She argued that because there wasn't a formal gag order in place specifically prohibiting discussion of the excluded evidence, it was procedurally improper to dismiss the entire case. She felt that without such a clear and explicit directive from the court, the drastic step of dismissal was unwarranted.
So she's saying that there should have been more explicit instructions from the court about what was and wasn't allowed in terms of public statements, and that without that, the dismissal was too severe a punishment.
That's right. And both dissenting justices also pointed out that there were alternative, less severe sanctions that could have been considered, things like fines or maybe pursuing contempt of court charges. They felt that those options should have been explored before resorting to the nuclear option of dismissal.
It's interesting, too, because you have this distinction between the plaintiff, who's not a lawyer and isn't bound by the same professional rules of conduct, and her attorneys, who are. Did the dissenting opinions address that?
Absolutely. They highlighted that distinction, arguing that the primary responsibility for understanding and following ethical rules lies with the attorneys. While the plaintiff's actions were definitely a factor, the dissenting justices felt that it was unfair to essentially punish her so severely for actions that might not have been as clearly prohibited for a non-lawyer.
It raises a really interesting question about the extent to which clients are held accountable for their own actions in a legal setting, especially when they might not be fully aware of all the nuances of legal ethics.
Right. And it also goes back to that point about the potential chilling effect. If people fear that their case could be thrown out just because they spoke out publicly, even if they were trying to raise awareness about a perceived injustice, it can make them hesitant to exercise their First Amendment rights.
It's that classic tension between protecting the integrity of the legal process and ensuring that individuals still feel empowered to speak their truth, especially when they're up against powerful institutions. So for all those future lawyers out there listening, what are the key takeaways from Maldonado? What lessons should they carry with them?
The biggest one is the importance of understanding the ethical tightrope that attorneys walk. You have to be a zealous advocate for your client, but you also have a duty to uphold the integrity of the judicial system and ensure a fair trial. And those two things aren't always easy to reconcile.
Yeah, it's about finding that balance. And Maldonado really highlights the need to pay attention to even informal warnings or guidance from the court.
Right. Even if there isn't a formal gag order in place, you can't just assume that you can say whatever you want about the case. Judges have a lot of inherent power, and they're not afraid to use it to protect the fairness of the trial.
And for those of you thinking about litigation, what strategies should you keep in mind when it comes to pretrial publicity?
Well, first off, consider requesting a protective order from the court if you think there's a risk of prejudicial information being disseminated. Also, be incredibly careful about your own public statements. Make sure they comply with the rules of professional conduct in your jurisdiction.
You don't want to inadvertently jeopardize your case by saying the wrong thing in public. And what about the client? How do you manage their public statements when they're not bound by the same ethical rules?
That's a tough one. But communication is key. You need to be very clear with your client about the risks associated with speaking publicly about the case, especially when it comes to things like excluded evidence.
Remind them that anything they say can potentially be used against them and that it's not worth risking their entire case just to get their side of the story out there. And ultimately, the big takeaway from Maldonado is don't mess with the court's authority.
Right. Even if you don't agree with a ruling, you can't just ignore it or openly defy it. Judges have a lot of power at their disposal. Mm. And if they feel like you're trying to undermine their authority or jeopardize the fairness of the trial, they won't hesitate to use it.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Maldonado v. Ford Motor Co., let's recap the key takeaways for our listeners. First, the courts place a high premium on the integrity of the judicial process. It's paramount. Sometimes that even means prioritizing it over an individual's claim.
Absolutely. And the substantial likelihood of material prejudice standard gives judges a lot of leeway to regulate pretrial publicity.
So be very, very cautious about any publicity related to an ongoing case. That line between advocating for your client and doing something that could be seen as prejudicial, It can be very thin.
And as Maldonado shows us, dismissal is a drastic measure, but it's a real possibility if you repeatedly ignore the court's warnings and act in a way that suggests you're trying to manipulate the process. It's a powerful lesson in the limits of advocacy.
It is. Always counsel your clients carefully about the risks of public statements during litigation. And for everyone listening, think about this. How do you balance a litigant's desire to speak out, maybe even to rally public support or shine a light on perceived injustices, with the court's responsibility to ensure a fair trial? It's a complex issue, especially in today's world of instant communication and social media.
Yeah, it's something we all need to grapple with. Maldonado provides a really stark example of just how high the stakes can be when those two competing interests collide. Thanks for walking us through this one.
Thanks for joining me on the Deep Dive.